Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We're here Sundays at 7 a.m., 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. Podcasts are at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. We do stream live during the radio broadcast at richarddugan.com. And we have the podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, as well as the homepage of richarddugan.com, where you can scroll through the programs of 2018. Eventually, we will get all of the rest of the programs up on SoundCloud as well. That'll take some time. Meanwhile, there are programs going back 10 years, going back. Go to the radio shows page, and you can click on the given year and scroll through, see who we have been talking with over the past 10-plus years. We're going to be talking, I think, with a woman who's got an extraordinary series, especially if you are into something that we were into really, really big back in 2014. And maybe you remember a series that we did here on the program. It was called Mythosophia, Exploring the Depths of Myth and Wisdom. And we covered a wide variety of programs. My co-host Will Lynn and I, who he is now a doctor, has his PhD, in mythology. We went all over the place. Well, we're going to continue in that vein of sorts. Will is not joining me today, but we're going to be talking with the author of a series. And I, first of all, want to thank Alisa for joining us on here on the program. Alisa Helming, thank you for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
This is extraordinary, and the book series, of course, as well as one of your companies that you are executive of, Protogenesis, and the subtitle is Before the Beginning. And basically, you delve into the area of mythology, or at least the myths and so forth. You also travel to Greece quite often in terms of doing research for this work. And I don't know about you, but I did not get the kind of education, if you will, in this area in school. And when we did this series of 12 programs in 2014, I was literally going to school, and my questions really came from a very novice perspective. How did this particular, and this particular work that we're talking about today, Protogenesis, Before the Beginning, this is the first in the series, correct?
It's the first of a series of 7 books, yes.
Okay. When you started out, were they originally going to be 7, or has that been something that just sort of evolved?
Well, at first I think it was going to be 3, and then as the story became more and more complicated, we realized that it needed to be much longer. And I say we because what I do is a community effort in a way, because I have so many, not just editors, but people in Greece that from everywhere that have helped me in some way with the book. So it feels like a real collaboration. And it's very interesting. The whole mythology aspect, though, I was not an expert in mythology at all. I think probably my exposure to it was like the myths that you see in the movies, like Star Wars and such.
Yeah.
So that was like my background, right? But my teenage niece, who was 17 at the time, she was very much into Greek mythology, and she came to me with the idea that we should write a book together about a young adult series with a love triangle that was involving Greek mythology. So that's how the whole thing started. And she ended up getting a scholarship to Germany where she couldn't write the book anymore. So she just let me continue writing it, and the story became something a little different than what we had in mind originally. But she became my young adult editor, and that's how the whole thing started with mythology. I learned as I went, basically, from there.
So you're self-educated. You have your own personal PhD in Greek mythology of sorts.
I feel like it because I've met with so many experts. I've met with experts in Socrates and Plato, and I've actually gone to the sites in Greece and worked with famous archaeologists to excavate sites. And so I've seen the archaeology side of it. I talked to mythology experts, and then also the philosophy side. So it's really interesting, definitely.
Why Greece?
Well, so if you look at a lot of these young adult series, there are, you know, for instance, Percy Jackson comes to mind. That's a very well-known one. And we certainly didn't want to be another Percy Jackson. And so this book is geared a little bit older than the Percy Jackson series, which is, first of all, a boy that's in the main role. And also, it doesn't have the love triangle and that aspect to it. But the other thing that I wanted to do was, if I thought of any place in the world to set a book about Greek mythology, it should be set in Greece. And so the only issue with that is, throughout all of my schooling and writing, we always learn you should write what you know. And I didn't know Greece. I'd only been there one day on a cruise ship, and I went to the Parthenon. It was really hot, and I was like, I don't know if I want to come back here. I mean, I loved it, but it was really, really hot that day. And so I didn't really know that much about Greece. So what did I have to do? I had to go there. And that's how I ended up going so many times.
I know that for myself, Ireland is where I have an affinity for. If I was going to write about anything, that would be where the stories would come from, and the history as well as the mythology. And so that's why I find it interesting. Everybody has their own connection to different parts of the world. I don't know about you. I had my DNA tested, what was it, last year. And, of course, I'd been saying as a kid growing up that I was Heinz 57. I was from all over the place. I hadn't had my DNA tested as a kid. But based upon all of the nationalities that I had been shared with by my parents and relatives, when my DNA was finally tested, it turns out I'm from 5 of the 7 continents. And what's interesting is I was using the term Heinz 57, 5 of the 7 was a rather interesting insight from that standpoint. Yeah, I'm not from Australia or Antarctica. Although I don't know how many people are from Antarctica. But again, we have these, and I'm only 10% Irish on my father's side. Only 10. Which is fine. But I guess what helps me is to cross the various nationalities one by one, as it were, and learn more about them. And obviously, there must be, if it's a percentage or less than 1%, I'm sure there's got to be Greek and Italian, and the list goes on. And I know that I could probably name off some of the characters from Greek mythology and philosophy and so on and so forth. But I always found it interesting that there was never a tie-in to my life today, so to speak, or how these stories and these philosophies could be a part of my everyday life, how I could incorporate them. I mean, I talked to Will Lynn. He's the co-host of the Mythosophia series. And we'll be just in general conversation over a cup of coffee. And he said, oh, well, that's like, and he'll start rattling off the story of this particular, of this particular myth. And I'm wondering about, as you began, let alone continue, research for this, as you say, 7-part series, Protogenesis. Do you find that you're able to, and I love this term, the word, comes from the book Stranger in a Strange Land, which I finally finished. Do you find yourself grokking the stories and really understanding and being able to put them into Elisa's context, if you will?
Well, so what's really interesting about how my whole story came about is that the whole thing came to me within about 2 weeks, the whole story.
Wow.
So the first book. And actually part of the second book as well. And so I wrote that whole thing out. And a lot of it, as I was working with the cultural editor really closely in Greece, who had a really strong mythology background, she kept going, oh my gosh, this is this myth. And this one over here is this one. And this one's this. And she was relating pretty much all of these stories, like little micro stories within the book, to actual myths. And so we added the references in parts of the book to those myths that she could relate to it. But I actually didn't even know that I was writing this. It's so weird. So, but you were talking about DNA just now, and I have not had mine tested, but there is probably a likelihood that I have some things in that region, but I'll tell you, it's not the DNA for me. It's a certain number. It's 3.14 pi.
Right.
That whole area, Pythagoras, and there's a lot of mathematics that come from Greece. And so pi is a significant number for me because I was born at 3:14 a.m. My wedding anniversary, which I did not plan, didn't think about this, is March 14th.
Oh, wow.
And I know. And so the numbers keep repeating. And so I didn't realize this before, but there's something called the Sacred Triangle in Athens. And so if you take the Parthenon, you take the Temple of Poseidon, and then there's another temple, it's of Artemis or Apothea. It's on an island right off the coast of Athens. It creates a perfect right triangle. And the angles of that right triangle all have some derivative of 3.14. And in the center of that triangle, the exact center, is the place that I first went to when I first visited Athens, and the place that I always went back to. I kept being drawn back to, and that's where I did a lot of the writing for the book. So it's if that number is what's drawing me back. And now here's one more instance. I ended up partnering with this rock star, a Greek rock star, who's famous in Greece, who wrote a song for the book. And his record label that produced the song and released it globally last month is 3.14 Records.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that crazy?
I think that's going to follow you around the rest of your life.
Yes.
Apparently, it already is.
That means.
Yeah. Well, I'm always into patterns, and you've obviously found a significant pattern, 3.14. Mine is just looking at numbers and sequences, and it's to me, it's fascinating. And by the way, I happen to be the beneficiary of a, I guess you could call it a trait of, I believe it's pronounced kinesthesia. Which is the ability to see letters and numbers in color.
Oh, I like that.
Which is has fascinated me all my life, and it actually helps to prove the point as far as language is concerned. This would be interesting. I'm curious. First of all, I'll go with this question first. Protogenesis, the first book, has it been translated into Greek yet?
Yes, and it was released on April the 19th in Greece with a publisher there.
Fantastic. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. One of the things that I find interesting about language is when something is written in the original language of the writer, whether we go back to the Old Testament or even the New Testament and so forth, and I have learned here and there that there are different types of Greek. You know, Old Greek and New Greek, those kinds of things, as with other languages. But with Hebrew, for example, I've done some study on the 22 characters, and each one of those characters has its own legend, has its own numerical rating, its tonal vibration, even story, if you will, behind it. And you start putting letters together with words, makes a whole new context. The words with other words into sentences, into paragraphs, chapters, books, etc. And you have this incredible tapestry. But the moment you take it out of that language and you translate it into any other language, and you've lost the tapestry.
Hmm.
And I'm wondering if there was any, how you were able to oversee, if you will, or make sure that when it was translated, let's just say, into Greek, and I don't know how many other languages at this point, because I'm sure it will be down the road into others, making sure that it's translated, shall we say, correctly or accurately, to make sure that your story doesn't get lost in translation.
Yeah. Well, I do have a team of people in Greece that I work with, and one of them is a cultural editor that helped me through the whole development of the book, and she really understood the story. She loves the story. She fell in love with it. And she is bilingual in Greek, so she oversaw that with a top translator. And the translator, Christos Katsis, is the translator for the Dan Brown book. So he's one of the top translators. And the reason he's top is because he really gets into the characters, the story, really tries to understand from the author's viewpoint what the key themes are and the key feeling and the tone of the book are in English and in talking to the author in order to do the translation. So I feel like it was really, really well done in Greek. I don't know about the other languages, but that was the most important one for me, certainly.
Now, you are the executive producer of a short film called Footsteps in Athens, as well as an American TV series, Meet Me in Greece, which is based upon your real-life story, which we also want to talk about. And obviously now you have this, you know, first of the first book of seven. And I am going to venture a guess that this work, I mean, if you were able to formulate the entire story in, what did you say, 2 weeks? 2 days?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Something like this seems to me rather, it seems like the time is ripe for these kinds of stories to be made into films or television series, those kinds of things. I will say this much, that I've gotten to the point now, and I don't know, maybe I'm jaded in that respect. I watch some television series that are on today, and I can't understand how they're in their sixth or seventh or eighth season. It's like, you're dragging this out. I am bored. Because yeah. It's like you keep repeating the same scenario. Make it a miniseries. We were watching, as a matter of fact, one miniseries from Britain some years ago on, I think it was Netflix, and it was only 4 episodes long, and it didn't leave you wanting. You know, it brought things to a conclusion, even though it didn't answer every single question. But it just seems like, obviously, if there's still money in it, they're gonna do what they can to keep it going. That's why I find it fascinating that they want to reboot so many, as they use the term, so many different old television shows. You know, and it's like, let them stay in history and be enjoyed as retro stuff. You know, classics.
Right.
You know,
yeah, I agree with you on that.
You know, but in terms of this becoming a movie or a television program, what's happening on those fronts? If you can share that with us.
Well, I can share a limited amount of information. So the short films basically follow the specific characters around Athens, the 6 different sites, and they're off the beaten path, places that you normally wouldn't know unless you're local. So it was a way to help drive tourism to Greece, and we partnered with Discover Greece, which is one of the largest nonprofits that works with the Minister of Tourism with Greece. So it was a real collaboration with the government and such there. So it was a really great film. In one area that the book is set in is in, at the time, 3 years ago when I was first visiting Athens, I told my driver very first thing, I want to go to the worst neighborhood in Athens, take me there. He's like, why? I'm like, because it's where I want to write my story. He's like, why are you doing it right there? So we ended up going there, and this place is called Metaxavio, and I'm probably not saying it exactly correctly, but it's the silk district. So they used to make silk. And there's graffiti everywhere. There was a lot of high crime in that area, Fort Greece. There's not a lot of crime, but that was the high crime area. And since we made a short film there, it was a 3-minute short film, and it was the most popular of the 6. And that area has revived over the last 3 years. And now across the street from the house that inspired the set piece for my book, one of the hottest bars in Athens now is across the street called Beauty Killed the Beast. And people go there and they hang out on the street right across the street from that house. And so I feel like, okay, you made a small difference. You helped revive the economy in an area that really needed help in Greece. So that felt really good. But my story, outside of the short films, there's 2 other aspects. One is for a Protogenesis series. It's somewhat like a young adult series like Twilight or Hunger Games. We want to be really, really big like that. So we want to do big movies. So really that's what I'm talking to the studios about. I'm working on books 2 and 3 right now. So we'll have a trilogy drafted by the end of the summer. And that will be the time to market the trilogy and movie series then to the studios. The TV series, though, now that is a different story because that's my real life story. And what's interesting about that is my whole life I've had kind of a gift. I don't know if it's a special gift like what you have, but when I write things in my journal, for instance, somehow those things, for better or worse, sometimes happen. And I never understood why or how it was happening, and I didn't really put all the pieces together that it was happening until I got a little bit older. But now that I look at the pattern throughout my life, I can see that it is true. And the biggest way I know this is the way that I got into writing, and that was my husband and I started the first wind farm company in Kansas back in 1998, before wind was big in the United States, and before Al Gore, and when fossil fuels was everywhere, and we were receiving death threats and sabotage and all kinds of things. All of that stress drove me to start writing. And what I did was I enrolled remotely with the UCLA screenwriting program, an extension program, and I started writing with a screenwriter the story of our life, of what we were going through. And I really just did it as therapy. So we weren't through all of that horribleness at the time, so I wrote the ending that I wanted in my screenplay. And the ending was wildly successful. Like, we blanketed the whole Midwest with thousands, you know, hundreds of thousands of wind turbines or whatever it was. You know, something really crazy, right? And so 3 years later, we ended up selling that company to an Italian utility, and now when we moved to California and started a solar company. But over the span of those 3 years, the exact ending that I wrote in my screenplay happened in real life.
Oh, wow.
I know. So I was like, oh, my God, that theory, right? And then I started, like, tracing back patterns of my life. And I used to do strategic plans for Fortune 500 companies where I had this track record where I would come in, I would write a plan that said, okay, follow this plan, and then the company would, and they would be really successful. And I had stock prices go up and all kinds of things. And then I had a really great career in that before I got into the wind business. So so this is kind of my thing. So the whole premise of the show, though, is, if you can write nonfiction and make it happen, what happens when you write fiction? And what if it's like a young adult book about a 17-year-old girl and she goes to Greece and she starts to meet two guys, right? Mm-hmm. She's involved in a love triangle, but hey, in real life, I'm 47 and I'm married, I have a child. You know, it's like, uh-oh, that's complicated. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting how you put that, and I'm also curious as to maybe even going back further, going back into your childhood in terms of some of the things that you may have experienced that maybe you didn't think, you haven't thought about since, and all of a sudden it's like, oh wow, I remember thinking about this as a kid, and boom, this stuff is happening to me real time, you know, in my real life, but it wasn't something that I planned on, at least not consciously anyway.
Well, what I would say is that often the things you write or that you want, they happen for you, but in a different way than you imagined they would happen, and in a different timing than you imagined. So, and that's part of that, the premise of this too, is, for instance, I always wanted to be a professional ballerina, and so I danced 15 years of my life, and then I injured my ankle and my whole career was over. I had no hope. So I had to go into economics, which is how I got into business. But I had that artistic side, and I was like, oh, I've always wanted to be a ballerina. And I even wrote that in my journal, right? Well, now, as I've gotten older, I started to appreciate ballet, and I started to go to San Francisco Ballet, and I met this ballerina, and she was on the rise at the San Francisco Ballet, which is an amazing company. And so when I partnered with this Greek rock star in Athens to create this song that he wrote for me for the book, I said to this ballerina, because I'd gotten to know her, would you like to come to Athens and be in this music video? You could star in a music video with a rock star, a Greek rock star. We'd have a great collaboration because she's not Greek either, like me, and that's a great international collaboration. So she said, oh, yes, of course, I'd love to. Well, the week before two weeks before she flew out to Athens, she got promoted to principal ballerina for the company, which is the highest rank you can get.
Mm.
So it's like, that was my goal when I was a kid. I wanted that. But now I've partnered with her, and I can live through her. And my character in my book also has that. that ballet aspect to it. So it's like all of those pieces are coming together, but not in a way that I would have imagined.
Well, I know that and I shared this in a previous interview with my guest, the response was rather interesting. But what I found interesting, there was a public service announcement several years ago that focused on the first scene was of a young boy who, a little boy, he and his friends were out in the yard and they were in a dirt pile playing with their trucks. And the next scene was of adults. Here was all these guys walking around with hard hats. One guy was walking around shirt and tie and holding blueprints and pointing and doing this and that and the other. The next scene was a third scene was of a little girl, and she was playing with her dolls and she was wrapping a bandage around its elbow or what have you. And then, of course, the fourth scene is here's this young adult who is working in the emergency room caring for patients. And the message that I got from that was, that which you enjoyed doing the most as a child is most likely the job that you should be pursuing as an adult because you were having fun doing it. Is there a correlation between what you're doing now and the way you were, the things that you played and the people you associated with as a child? Is there a connection? Do you see that?
Yeah, definitely. So besides the ballet, which was a huge passion of mine, as soon as I started reading, probably around age 5 or 6, I started writing too. And often I would take books that I would read and create screenplays out of them. And then by the time I was in seventh grade, I was putting on plays that I had written, and often I would even star in the play, and I would rally the whole school practically. They were smaller schools in Kansas City where I was at. And we'd have big, elaborate productions that I created. So what I'm doing right now is basically what I was manifesting as a child. So, I mean, you're exactly right about that.
Yeah, it's very – and, of course, we on this program talk an awful lot about finding your purpose in life. And to me, go back to your childhood. Most likely, that's where it's at. And bring it into the present. I know that, I mean, one of the things that I enjoyed, of course, was that playing in the dirt. The comment made by one of my guests was, that's too bad how sexist and stereotypical that was. And it's like, well, that wasn't the point of it. Granted, I won't deny that it wasn't stereotypical. Okay, I won't deny that.
Right.
But the point that I saw was that you need to go back and check that out. I'm curious also about, within all of this, within the mythology and the philosophy and so forth, and I refer to other, shall we call them, belief systems as philosophies, because really that's what they are. I was born and raised in the Catholic, Western Catholic philosophy. I had exposure to the Eastern Rite philosophy of the Catholic Church, as well as the Baha'i faith. I've learned an awful lot about the Jewish traditions and the Baha'is, and I'm learning some about the Muslim faith and Zen Buddhism, and I don't know, the hundreds of others that have existed or that exist today, because I'm curious. I'm curious as to what people believe, and I'm curious as to where you come from philosophically as well as spiritually.
Okay. Well, so that's a little bit complicated. I was raised Christian and Methodist, and I did everything properly. I converted, and I think I really, really believed in it all when I was younger. And my father, I'll just tell you this, my father was the lead product engineer for Hallmark for Christmas ornaments since the 70s. So basically, we had 10 Christmas trees filled with ornaments and just growing every year. So he was like the Christmas guy. So I love the culture of Christianity as much as religion. Mm-hmm. And it became a very big part of my life and my house and everything growing up. And I've been married twice, and my first marriage was to someone who was Jewish. And it was really hard for me because I was a very Christian person, right? And to think about having a family with, you know, to have the Jewish religion is part of that. And so what happened was I ended up going through the conversion process almost as an educational process. I thought, oh, you know, I'm probably not going to do this because it's not my faith. But as I went through it, I was fascinated. There's so many aspects to Judaism that I absolutely loved, and a big part of it was going through and debating what you read, like in the Bible, like in the Old Testament, for instance, in the book of Genesis. If you start reading different sections of it, a big part of the Jewish tradition is to argue and to debate what it really means, instead of like listening to a minister in church say, mm-hmm. oh, this is what it means, so this is what you should do. And so it was a different philosophy in that way as far as the cultural way of looking at spirituality and religion. And that really changed things for me. So I would say that I take aspects of Christianity and things that I absolutely love about that, about culture and religion. And then I also have a really strong foundation now of the Jewish side of things. And then I love Buddhism, and I did have a chance to travel to Asia and to different parts of the world to study other religions. And I feel like there are aspects of every philosophy, as you say, that that are very similar. The people aren't that dissimilar in their beliefs. It's just that there are specific cultural practices and things that are really different in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I take a lot from many different faiths, but I come back to Christianity because that's my culture. That's the background that I grew up in.
Right. The thing that I have always enjoyed, especially with conversations I've had with rabbis on this program, is the one thing that they've always told me about, specifically the Old Testament, but I think this applies to the New as well, and any other what I like to refer to as the ancient wisdom teachings, is context. And many times, as you and I both know, people take passages out of context to support their particular position on whatever it might be.
Exactly,
yeah. And I remember a conversation I had with a rabbi once, and he shared with me the reason why, for example, one of the, I won't go into specifics, but one of the 613 laws, Jewish laws in the Old Testament. He says, do you know why that law was instituted? And I said, well, based upon my Christian upbringing, and I worked for a Christian radio station for 15 years, and what they used to say regarding this particular law and why they were bashing other people over the head with it, was this. And he says, no, that is not the reason why. And then he went into the reason why that law was instituted. And it had absolutely nothing to do with the reasons that were placed, that have been spoken of. And then the other aspect of it, too, is you actually did the right thing by becoming a Jew, because if I was really, truly going to follow Jesus, wouldn't I be a Jew? He wasn't a Christian. He was a Jew, right?
You know what? The funny thing is that you can't really unconvert from Judaism.
No,
you converted.
Yeah.
And so I don't. I'm also a Christian.
Yeah, sure. No.
I'm confused, I guess.
Yeah.
I do love Jesus, and I love the whole philosophy of all of it. So.
I love the ritual and tradition, the ceremonies of the Catholic Church that I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
I still remember my very first, or one of my early attending of a Byzantine Rite Catholic Mass, which many people think is Greek Orthodox, but it is not. And it was a warm February morning, Sunday morning, and of course they've got the incense going. Well, they actually had all the windows open because it was so warm. I almost passed out.
Oh, God. It's like a Bikram yoga, right?
Exactly. But I have a copy of the Slavonic liturgy. I have a printed copy of the Slavonic liturgy. Now, if you were to videotape a ceremony, a mass, say 50 years ago, and then today, they're going to be basically the same. With the exception of the homily, they're going to be identical. It's one of the aspects of it that I like, because they stay focused. The cantors are on the holidays, Easter and Christmas and other holy days on the Catholic calendar. Those are the things that you know, my mother at the age of 16, I was at the age of 16. She came to me and she said, "Hey, it's time to get up and go to Mass." And I delivered newspapers, and I just gotten home and delivered the Sunday papers, and I wanted to sleep. And I said, "I really don't want to go." And she's okay, which shocked the daylights out of me, because every other time it was get up and let's go. In my 20s, I asked her why. She said, "Well, because I didn't want you to push away." And I never did. I'm not practicing Catholic anymore, but I didn't push away from it. I just did not feel as though it was serving me the way that I needed to be. And that's why I'm rather eclectic in my and a part of the reason for the curiosity. I mean, I even went to our neighbors were Mormons, and I went to one of their services one Sunday morning. And when I got home, apparently unbeknownst to my mother, she found out that I'd gone. She said, "Okay, time to go to Mass," you know, because I hadn't been yet, number one. And that didn't count.
Oh, gosh.
And she wasn't upset in that respect of how dare you. It was, this is what we do as Catholics on Sunday. We go to Sunday Mass. That was not Sunday Mass.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But it's one of the reasons that we do this program, is try to put forth to folks these different ideas, these different concepts, especially in the context. I like some of the things that are written here in regards to the main character in your book. And again, the title of the book is Protogenesis Before the Beginning. This is book one of seven, and talking about how, the aspect of her truth. And again, the main character in the book is the ultimate dare in Greece, and talking also about myths. Her myths are her reality. And it's almost similar to what you were talking about. A lot of the things that, like you said, that one dream, if you will, became a reality. That one thought became a reality in this day and age. And I'm wondering, too, about your experiences with your own, not just dreams, but maybe your own intuition.
Well, I think there's a lot of karma involved in my own story, but Helene, the main character in this book, you can see a transformation from the beginning of the book to the end of the book. She finds herself through this ancient secret that she finds, and that ancient secret takes the reader to before the beginning, but before religion. Mm-hmm. Before civilization, and it redefines mythology as we know it.
Interesting.
And in a way that ties everything to something that could be real. So, meaning, I use modern science, quantum physics, technology now to define this in a way that you go, "Oh wow, maybe that could be what really happened," and maybe that's why these myths came about, why they were told this way.
Yeah.
Because this might have happened that way. So it's, but I do skirt around religion, so there's no controversy there for sure.
Right, right. And of course, I understand it's not intended in that respect. I also noticed, too, that there is, okay, and this is my eyes, this is what I see. There is a little bit of a similarity between you and the depiction of Helene on the front cover.
Well, okay, so I'll tell you, my niece and I, because we were writing together initially, we went on Google and we found faces that represented the main characters of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had like 20 faces up on the wall, and she would write, I would write, and it would be similar in how those characters look. But we didn't really know who the people were. So the woman that I had on the wall was an actress. Her name is Marie Antheropoulos. And so that picture on the cover of the book is a mix of me and her, and that's the Mona Lisa smile. Because we wanted something that you could, you know, really recognize. You know, like, oh, I know that look. So that's how we came up with that image on the front. But the other really weird story about that is one of the faces on the wall was a guy who's the main love interest in the book. And I didn't know anything about him at all. And then when I finally went to Greece after writing that face for 6 months, I was driving from the airport to the hotel, and alongside the road were these banners. And there was a singer on the banner. And it was a guy that I'd been writing for 6 months. But I'd been writing a guy who was about 5 or 6 years younger, because mine was a teenager. And this guy was an older guy. I'm like, whoa, is that really him? He's great. Wow. And so I couldn't read his name because it was in Greek. So I went to the hotel, and I asked the concierge first thing, can you find a singer that looks like this? And she's like, oh, there's a lot of singers that look like that. So we scrolled through all the faces that she could think of online, and finally there was his face, and it was him. And she says, that's Costa. He lives near here. He knows the hotel owner. She's like, oh, my God, you might actually meet him. I'm like, oh, no, I don't want to meet him. Come on, I'm not finished the first draft of the book yet. I can't meet him. That would be bad. Well, so my sister and I went to the beach, and we're sitting there. We just got off the plane. We looked like crap. We're watching the sunset, and there's some guy next to us that's sleeping on the beach with a hat over his head, and he's got a really interesting tattoo on his arm with these birds that are flying. I thought, wow, that's a really cool tattoo. Well, so after he left and we went back to our hotel, I finally had the guy's name, right? So I looked him up on Instagram, and there on his Instagram was a picture of him on the beach with that tattoo sitting right there. Like, oh, my God, I sat next to that guy, the guy that was on my wall. So as you said, this is how fiction becomes reality, and how I think throughout our life we find ways of manifesting things that the writer would think or visualize. It happens.
Yeah, there are no accidents. There are, however, coincidences. Okay.
Okay.
That's how I pronounce it now. Been pronouncing it that way for about 10 years. Coincidence, but coincidences.
Okay.
And the reality is that things, we may not know the reason, but things happen for a reason as we go through our lives. And in your case, you know, you've had one instance after another that continues to corroborate your path. I don't know if you feel like this or not, but do you feel as though you've been in the right place at the right time most of your life?
No, I think that there's been times where I've been off my path, and I've had really hard times, just like anybody. Like with the wind farm thing, that was really my husband's dream, and we were, you know, doing that. And I did buy into, you know, clean energy and all that. I'm into it. It's not my dream. It's not my path. And so I learned a lot from all those moments. But I feel like this, when you find your path, it's like then that's when everything starts, like as you say, to happen as it should, and it feels like everything's very easy. It's just falls into place. You meet the right people at the right time. And in this case, when I did finally meet this rock star 2 visits later, he was so excited about the project that he decided he wanted to write a song for the book. And that really helped me with getting the message of the book out and for me to really fall in love with the magic of Greece and want to promote it and do everything that I'm doing. It really required to have that partnership with him. And he's become a really good friend. He's friends with my family, my husband, everybody. And it's a really, really nice collaboration that we have. We're really, really blessed.
That's very cool. We're talking with the author of the soon-to-be, we hope, 7-part series, Protogenesis. The first book is entitled Before the Beginning. Alisa Helming is my guest, and we're going to continue our conversation here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay right where you are.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. We're talking with Alisa Helming about her, I think it's a great project, not only as far as stories go, but also just in terms of the path that your life is taking and the messages that are shared through the mythology that is discussed within the pages. And who knows, maybe even from the standpoint on the small and let alone large screen. Protogenesis, Before the Beginning, is part one, if you will, or book one. And we're talking about Helene. And I'm wondering, too, as I just mused about how there's some similarity between you and the character as far as the front cover image of this first book. Can you give us a little, because, again, I don't want to give away too much in reference to the story, but a little background on Helene as far as how she's gotten to this place where she's now having these incredible experiences and doing all of this searching and finding and living, as it were, through the words in your pages?
Sure. Yeah, sure. So the story opens with Helena's lost her mother in a fire, and she's devastated by that. And as she's processing that, the police come and an attorney that her mother hired comes to her house, and there's evidence. It's like a coin that's found on site of the fire that leads Helena to believe that her mother's still alive. And then her attorney says, well, she thinks she has no relatives, no place to go. And he says, well, you have this relative, this godfather in Crete, in Athens, that may be able to help you. You know, if you really believe your mom's alive, then you should go there, because your mother really wanted you to go to live with him if anything would happen to her. So she ends up going to Greece, and she moves there initially thinking she's going to find her mom. She absolutely believes that she has this connection in her heart with her mother, like she calls it the love pipe, for instance. It's this connection that she feels like whenever something is wrong, her mother pops up out of bed and knows instantly, and vice versa, like they know. So she knows in her heart that her mom is alive. And she goes, when she first arrives in Greece, she meets this cast of characters and all these people. She goes to an international high school where there's kids from all over the world. And she ends up meeting two guys. One of them is a very wealthy shipping owner family guy named Ever. And then the other one is an next-door neighbor, and he's from a family that is going through the crisis and it's hitting his family very, very hard. And the whole family lives in a tiny little apartment. They can't find a job. The dad has the tax authorities after him. And so she experiences, as an American girl, the whole depth of what's going on in modern Greece through that love triangle. And as that goes on, she finds this secret doorway, I will say, to this place where she finds that ancient secret that we talked about. And that's how she starts to put the pieces together about the gods and how they're involved in all of this. It was definitely mythology, there's gods, but it's a much more realistic view of the gods than you would have in other series.
Hmm. It makes me think of a poem I've paraphrased a number of times on this program about the gods, and they're getting a little concerned about man because man is becoming wiser and smarter and is kind of cluing in on who and what he is as a being in the universe, and they're afraid that eventually man may find them, may become them, and so they need to hide the secret. And they talk about where they're going to hide the secret, and we'll hide it on the mountaintops. Oh, he'll find a way to climb there. We'll put it down in the bottom of the deepest spot of the sea. Oh, he'll find a way to get there. And they go through a list of things. Finally, one of them pipes up and says, I know where we'll put it. We'll put it in his heart. He'll never look there. and that's kind of what that's kind of what that sounds like, a little bit in that respect.
A little bit.
It's in terms of again, you talked about meeting this wonderful musician, Kostas, and is it
Martakis?
Martakis.
Yes.
I'm getting my T's and my K's all mixed up there. Yes. Kostas.
Yes.
The only real Greek person I know is John Stamos. Okay.
Okay.
I can pronounce him. And as I shared with you before we started, I used to produce the program was called the All New Greek Family Hour.
Oh.
And back in Phoenix, and I did that for a number of years. And of course, every spring or early summer, they would have a Greek festival. And of course, I think I attended that a few times. And they would do the show partly in Greek and partly in English. And of course, played a lot of Greek music. And it was really, really fascinating. And I have to say that the majority of the songs, the majority of the music was very upbeat and uplifting and very energetic and happy and, you know, that party atmosphere, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I want to make a sort of a comparison here and see what you think. I've observed a lot of documentaries that I've seen, especially of various tribes in various parts of Africa, where they are wearing very colorful, brightly colored clothing. And of course, my first question is, okay, are they wearing this brightly colored clothing for the documentary, or is this their normal attire? Turns out it is their normal attire. And I'm thinking, wow, these people are living in, they're living in such, you know, by our standards, such deplorable conditions, and yet they always seem so happy. And I'm wondering about the Greek culture seems to be kind of that same way. There isn't a lot of moroseness, or, you know what I'm saying? It's there's an upness, there's a happiness, there's a lift, a lilt, if you will, from the Greek culture. From, again, this is from my limited experiences from the people I associated with that program as well.
Right. You know what I think it is? It's perseverance. Because if you look at the history of the Greek people and all the wars and all of the things that have happened to them through history, it's how they band together, and they're very family and culturally oriented, where they band together, and it's basically, you know, us against, you know, we're all here, we're going to do this, we're going to make it, and they're really, really good at doing that. And the other thing that I think is really interesting about Greece is hospitality is always important to them. They always want to open their doors to any tourists and outside people in the most friendly way as possible. Now, when dealing with each other, I'm not sure it's exactly like that. But unless there's a crisis going on, and then they rally, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you're seeing as a tourist, too, is you're seeing... Or a non-Greek like me, and that's part of the reason I had, I think, such great reception for my project, is I'm bringing a lot of different people together that are Greek that wouldn't maybe normally partner with each other, because I'm not Greek, and they see this as an opportunity to showcase Greece, and they're very proud of that, and they this whole hospitality aspect is very, very strong in that culture. So they always will put on a nice face for you if you're from the outside.
Right.
I found that for sure. That's why it took me so many visits. I had to go back. I went back 20 times over 2.5 years. And part of the reason I was able to do that is through my business career, I had a lot of frequent flyer miles banked, so I could do it fairly inexpensively. I also met people, and I started to stay in their home, my friends. So I have some of my closest friends that live there that I'm able to do it. But it really takes so many visits to really get into what it really is like there for the people.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not real open about, oh, we're going through a crisis, we have to work 3 jobs, we have to hide our money under the floorboards. You know, they're not going to tell you about all that.
Right, right. Well, I guess every culture is kind of sort of that way. You know, they kind of keep to themselves, and they share with you what they want to share with you, and certainly want to put on a good face, because, you know, you're there, you're visiting, you're a guest, and they want their guests to feel, well, to feel like guests, I guess, and feel like they can come back down the road as well and enjoy the hospitality that they would like to be known for. I know that, I mean, just as an individual and in my own relationship, I have always enjoyed having people over to the house for dinner parties or whatever, some type of gathering. It's so much fun, and I want them to come back. So, yeah, I'm going to, I don't care if I'm on the verge of some terminal illness and my finances are in the toilet and all that stuff. Exactly. I'm not going to show them that.
No. And you're going to enjoy yourself when you're with them, and it's going to take you away from those problems.
Exactly.
Right? You're going to have that moment when you can have freedom from that.
Exactly.
By being with people. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting how you know, we do tend to do that. I mean, I've experienced that even in when we visited Ireland at the early part of the century. We were there in 2002-03, and then 2004, February of 2004, for 2 weeks at a stretch, and absolutely loved it. I love the people. I could sit in a pub with a pint and just listen to them talk. I just love, I love listening to them.
I love Ireland too. You know, people are just so nice there.
Yeah.
They're so courteous.
But they have their own problems, just like you and me, right? They have their own issues. They got stuff
going
on.
Definitely.
But just like I'm sure the Greeks, they want you to feel welcome, and they want to show you a good time and so forth. And, you know, hey, you know what? I can do that, show you a good time now, because, you know, my problems are not going away, you know.
Exactly.
They'll be there when I'm done.
Only live once, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I have to say that this has been an extraordinary journey, and I encourage people to continue that journey by picking up a copy of the book as well. And we encourage you to go to the website, and I had it. Ah, there it is right there. Actually, you can go to your website, which is alishahelming.com. That's alishahelming.com. And you can not only check out Protogenesis, the first book before the beginning, which is interesting. I suppose that's a good place to start, before the beginning. You know?
Sure, why not?
I mean, you know, hey, everybody starts at the beginning, right? Let's do something
exactly.
Different. Let's start
before the beginning.
I love it. I love it. Alisha, thank you so much for sharing your time and story with us here on the program. And we're going to wrap up the program here in just a moment by listening to that particular song that goes along with the book and as well as the program.
By Forever and Tonight.
Forever and Tonight. And it'll this is Kostas, who's going to be singing in just a few moments. And before we let you go, I know you're down in Los Angeles, but, you know, should you find your way up here to Santa Barbara, we'd love to have you in studio to talk more about this and or talk about book two when it comes out, as well as the visual treatments that are coming. And I have a question real quickly. Has this been done into audiobook yet?
Not yet.
Oh, fantastic. That'll be great. Before I let you go, I want to ask you three final questions. And again, on my thanks for giving us so much time here on the program. First question is, who is Alisha Helming?
Who is Alisha Helming? That's a good one. Wow. Okay, well, right now I'm an author. That is a really hard question. How do normal people, what do they say usually? I would say that I was a business person my whole life, and I always followed, I didn't always follow rules, but I definitely was much more of a rule follower. And now I've gotten to that point in my life where I'm on my midlife adventure. And that adventure is magical. And it's taking me to Greece, and I'm writing and doing everything I dreamed about. There are some bumps in the road always, but if you keep your eye on the dream and aim up and it keep going up, you're on the right track, and that's where I'm at.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
For me, it's I have fallen in love with this country, so I want to help revive the economy. My major was in economics, so I really want to see something happen out of the efforts that I have. And I feel like if I could make the next Hunger Games or Harry Potter series, then if I had that kind of influence, then I can certainly help the cause in the best way that I can. So that's my biggest goal.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Well, I believe my life's purpose right now is to bring an amazing story to the world that inspires people and women and people who are Greek and also grief. So anything that that involves grief, strong women, and doing and sticking with your dreams, following your dreams, writing things and manifesting them, or even visualizing them to manifest them. If I can inspire people in any of those ways, then I feel like I succeeded.
Well, Alisha Helming, thank you so much for sharing, your book, Protogenesis, as well as your story with us here on the program, and we do look forward to having you back again.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
AlishaHelming.com. That's AlishaHelming. That's H-E-L, beg your pardon, M-I-N-G. We will be linked to the website, so you just go there. You don't have to spell it. You just click on it, and away you go. And I hope you will stay with us. We're going to wrap up with the song that Kostas has shared, and Alicia has shared with us as well. And we encourage you to maybe pick up the track Forever and Tonight here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Until next time, love to love.
Like this, the stars above are shining. As a chameleon, I'm changing in your eyes. I will be yours till the sun rises. I want you now, don't you see? Burn your boundaries and come with me. I want forever in this night. Take me in your arms and hold me tight. I want you now, don't you see? Feel the way I feel and be with me. I want forever in this night. Eternity begins tonight. Come hold me our heaven, and we're chameleons to fall in love with light, falling in love with forever. I want you now, don't you see? Burn your boundaries and come with me. I want forever this night. Take me. Tonight.